during the talk or during the questions, that if you need to go to the toilet, please don't be embarrassed, because we're doing the forgiveness ceremony at the very end, so you can include that into the forgiveness ceremony, what you are forgiveness for. So please feel quite free to get up and go to the toilet if you do need to. But as I mentioned earlier, this is the last time when we're all together as a group before. And some people leave us in Bangkok, some people go to Singapore, some people go to US, London, New Zealand. So this is special, it's the last evening we're in India. So I just wanted to sum up what we've been doing for the last 2 weeks on this pilgrimage. And we started off in Bodh Gaya, decided to see the Buddha's enlightenment place. I think what many of you noticed there was the power of the place, so many monuments, so many old buildings and new buildings as well. Just wondered why it was that that place became so special. Some of you meditated there overnight, got some really nice powerful meditations. Still something in these places which help you to get into the deep states of calm and clarity. And it's interesting, we started at that place rather than the place where the Buddha passed away, or rather than the place where the Buddha was born. We started at that place first of all, because that was a defining event. But of course that was not just the end, because one of the last places we went to was the deer park in Benares, because really that's the next important thing which happened in the Buddha's life, where he started teaching. When we were in Sarvati, in Benares, I gave at least one talk when I was there, which the word of mouth has got back to me, that really interested many of you. It really stirred you, and it's meant to stir you up, because at that point in Benares, that was where the Buddha stirred up the world, by turning the wheel of the Dhamma, turning something new, pointing out something which many people had never seen before, and never even contemplated before. And eventually those teachings which were given at the deer park became so powerful, and you could see the representations, say the images which many of you saw in the museum today. Many of those images, you can see little two deers at the bottom, a Dhamma wheel somewhere, the Buddha turning the wheel of the Dhamma. It's the most important event, one of the most important events of the life. So we saw that as well. And after turning the wheel of the Dhamma, teaching the Dhamma, we saw, not in that order, we saw some of the places where the Buddha lived. At the Vulture's Peak, which is that typical Buddhist recluse monk places, that's where you'd expect the monks to be. Not in great cathedrals, not in great buildings, but in simple caves. And that had an atmosphere to it. That's like what I say is like monk place. Meditation place. That's the sort of place you go. And we also saw Vaisali, which was also very peaceful, but another type of peace there. Just a tranquility surrounding that old stupa, Chaitya. And also at Sarvati, the Chaitya Grove, where we spent a day and a half. Well, just a whole day, sorry. That was also an incredibly tranquil place. So hopefully you've got a feel for what like Buddhist monasteries were. Because the monasteries were the symbols of the Buddha, symbols of the Dhamma, symbols of the teachings. Just like they have cathedrals, those were the cathedrals of Buddhism. Not big buildings, but calm, empty, peaceful places. That's why I think I mentioned to a few people at the Vulture's Peak. That to me is like the Vatican of Buddhism. And the Vatican, like with no walls, and the ceiling is the sky, and just the emptiness. And Michelangelo could not paint such a picture as the sun rising over the Vulture's Peak, which we witnessed on that morning. That is the great work of art. That's got an atmosphere and a peace about it. A very simple peace, which is really what I always thought religion should be. Simplicity, purity, not part of the world. If you want to see a big building, go and visit a bank. But if you want to see religion, visit some sort of empty, some emptiness somewhere. And the last of all, last part of the Buddha's life was at Kusinara, where he passed away.
We saw that place as well. And again, that had a very powerful effect, certainly on me. And I gave the teaching there. Why that was, for some monks anyway, even more important than the place where the Buddha became enlightened. Because that was where the enlightenment started a process, as it were. And this is where the whole process was finished. Where a great being left samsara once and for all. And just to cap it off, we saw, you know, after the Kusinara, after the last hours, the last minutes of the Buddha spent in jhana, then we actually saw the relics. First of all, we saw the mounds where those relics were supposed to be put originally, and then we saw some of those relics in the Patna Museum. But then today you saw the relics up close. It's a fitting end to the pilgrimage. We see this with the relics of the Buddha, that there in this city of Delhi we can actually see the bones, which are most convincing of being the real bones, are taken from the cremation pyre of the Buddha about 2543 years ago. The dates in the Buddhist era were always taken from the cremation of the Buddha, not the birth of the Buddha, not even the enlightenment of the Buddha. They always say the years, like in the Buddhist calendar, which is 2548, I think. And that's after the Paramibbana of the Buddha. That's when they started counting. And we saw some of those relics there today. And those relics, as it were, like sum up sort of what we've been doing here. It's trying to see not just the Dhamma, which is like the, in one sense, the real relic of the Buddha, the real teaching of the Buddha. That's what really the Buddha represents to many people. Just the physical remnants are just a part, but sometimes it's great to see the physical remains of a Buddha. We saw that in the great temples and the great shrines, in the caves. That was like a physical remainder of the Buddha, like his footprint. Just like a person goes in the world and leaves their footprints. So this great being, the Buddha, left his footprint in Bodh Gaya, left a footprint in Mumbini as well, where we went for the Buddha's birth. Left his footprint in the Deer Park, left his footprint in Kusinara, and the places where he lived as well, in Vaisali and Rajgir, the Vulture's Peak, and Sarvati. He left his footprint there, and you can actually feel the real relics of the Buddha, the atmosphere of those places and what it meant. But still it's nice to see the physical remains as well. We saw that today, in the fitting end, to take leave of the physical remains of the Buddha, and actually to, as if like cremating those remains, leaving them here in India, and taking instead back to Australia, or to London, or to Texas, or to New Zealand, or to Perth, or to Melbourne, taking back, or to Thailand, taking back the remains which are in one's heart, the memory of this journey. It's been a long journey, and it has to be a long journey because there's many places. And if any of you are interested, when you go home, you can read the stories of the Chinese pilgrims, Fa Xian, and I'm not sure I pronounce it correctly, Hun Xian, whatever his name is, Xian, and actually read what they did. It took them years to get here. And they managed to write about it because they survived while others died on the way. That many of their friends never made it. Well, they made it there, but they never made it back again. And it has been so difficult to make these pilgrimages. And I was just remembering when I made my first pilgrimage to India as a Buddhist, and I was 22. I had my 22nd birthday here in India. And at that time, because there was no help, there was no book around in those days when I was 22, so I just had to try and make my own way. And I could not get to Lumbini. The roads were out, there were floods, it was the rainy season, and I was told there's so many rivers to cross, they were impassable. So I just never got there, my first trip, it was in 1973. And then Kusinara, where the Buddha passed away, I could find that on no map. And so I came here to Delhi, especially to try and find out from the tourist office where Kusinara was. And I went there and asked these people behind the desk, and they didn't know. And so in the end I never got there. So if any of you ask, like an Indian
on the street, where's the way to the airport? They'll say this way when it's that way. They'll say that way when it's over there. And this is actually what it's like in this country. So it's very, very difficult. And of course I did get sick a couple of times while I was here, and I was young enough to be able to enjoy it without too much problem. It's wonderful we've been able to make this trip with hardly any discomfort. Just a little bit of tiredness, a little bit of tummy ache maybe. It's amazing that it's all been organised so well. You can go back to your home country, to your hometowns. I think it'll only be after a few days when you realise what you've done and where you've come and what a trip it has been. And it has been like a, not a 5-star, a 10-star trip compared to the pilgrims of old. And being able to actually to see all these amazing things, even that big Buddha statue, in the beautiful Buddha statue in Sarnath, the most beautiful Buddha statue in the world, I would say. Be able to see that and get close to it. Just that by itself was worth the whole trip. But you've seen so much more. You've felt so much more. Whether you're a Buddhist or a non-Buddhist, you'd always understand the Buddha was one of the great beings. You've been in his footsteps on this journey. Not just seeing the places like many tourists do. Not just going there, like I was told of one trip which came from Singapore, they were so rushed. You take them to Sarnath, Sarnath, this is this stupid, that's that stupid, this is this stupid, and I get back on the bus. You go back to Bodh Gaya, this is where the Buddha became enlightened, this is where he walked, this is where he did this, and I get on the bus. I never had a chance to really feel the place. So this pilgrimage which we've done here, we've had a chance to feel it. And also I've had these meetings in the evenings, in many of the evenings when we haven't been too tired, to do some meditation and also to give some stories from the time of the Buddha and some of the great teachings which he gave at these places to find out why they were powerful, what happened there. And hopefully that's joined together with the physical visit, the place, the scene, to put those teachings and the scenery together to make the whole experience even more meaningful. Challenging as well, like this journey has been challenging. It's not easy to sit in a bus for so long and to be sleeping in a different place every night and always having to move at this time, get up at that time. It's not easy, but then neither is the Dhamma easy to understand. They go together. It's been challenging. It's meant to be challenging, but hopefully we've all come out of this better human beings, more inspired, with a meaning in life which is much greater than shopping, much greater than the material things. So what you take back with you is not what's in your bags, it's what's in your hearts. That's the greatest thing which I hope you'll take back, something which you can never declare to the customs. When they ask you, are you carrying any valuables? You say yes. The valuables in my heart were priceless. Because I've been on a pilgrimage to the place where the Buddha lived and breathed and talked and meditated. And that's the greatest valuable you can have. The Dhamma in your heart. So, now I know there were some questions left over from the talk which I gave at Hotel Clark's outside of Sarnath the other day. So are there any Q&A, questions and answers before we go any further? I really started getting into talking about non-self and the will. It's a fascinating subject to talk about because even some Buddhists who have been Buddhists for a long time, it's right there black and white in the books. That the will, the Pali word, is Chaitana, literally means of the mind, and it's said quite clearly that Chaitana is not me, not mine, not a self. So if it's not yours, if it's not you making all these choices, who is it? It gets quite scary for many people. In fact, it's one of the most scariest of teachings, Anatta, and a lot of monks just don't have the guts actually to teach it, and to teach it straight down the middle instead of making accommodations to their listeners. I like teaching it as it truly is, not just from the books but from experience as well.
and it challenges us, but it's a fascinating challenge. And it also brings into line what meditation's all about. Many of you meditated for a long time. You don't understand why you're meditating. It's not just, well, you know, maybe just for the bliss and the peace, but it's also when you're doing this letting go business, what are you doing? What are you letting go? This very will, which isn't yours anyway. You understand how this non-self and meditation all work together? The meditation of letting go is a means of realizing the end of will, the end of doing. Now you can understand why meditation is sometimes so difficult. It sounds so easy. It would be so easy if you can just get out of the way and let it happen. I often tell that in meditation instructions. Meditation is the easiest thing in the world to do. You don't have to do anything. Let go, do nothing. Renounce, abandon, allow it to be. Sounds easy, doesn't it? Why isn't it easy? Because you've got yourself in there which will not just let go. It's attached, it's clings. And that's why people aren't enlightened. You can understand as you do your meditation, you're learning about what this clinging is and what attachment truly is. It's not so much what you're attached to out there, it's what's doing the attaching inside. The world, the me. When you start to meditate, that's what you see, that's what you unravel. The more you let go, the more selfless you become. The more you are still, the more the will disappears. And when the will completely disappears, when there's nothing to move your mind, that's called jhanas. You're still. There's nothing which can shake you in those states. That's why you want to understand what peace is. But the more you're willing, the more you're controlling, the more you're doing things, the more you complain, the further you are away from peace. You don't make the world perfect by complaining about it. You make the world perfect by letting go of praise and blame, letting go of the whole lot, not doing anything. That's why, have you heard me complain? About doing this trip. Actually, I did once. Do you remember when I complained? When I went into Sarnath, that museum, and I saw the cover up. I went, oh no. And that's recorded on the tape. I'm going to throw it up. That was actually a great effect because Cody said, oh no. And everyone's heart went down. But then they took the cover off. And everyone's heart went up. Beautiful. That was great drama. So anyone got any questions about the avatar business? Yeah, go on.
You said
about
the difference between enlightenment, consciousness stops. What's left
for you? Okay, yeah. Remember there's two types of enlightenment. There's the enlightenment with the candles remaining, the candles being the body and the four mind candles. So in other words, that's the enlightenment of the arahat. Person who is fully enlightened, who walks this earth, who speaks and teaches the Dhamma like the Buddha or like an Ajahn Chah said.
There's a consciousness there.
There's still conscious, yeah. Conscious, yes. The Buddha was a conscious being when he taught. Ajahn Chah was certainly conscious. But that's the arahat. When that arahat passes away, what's called parinibbana, the second nibbana, the full complete nibbana, and that's when consciousness ceases. So at that point, there's no one to enjoy anything. There's nothing left at all. Everything's completely ceased. The alternative is just to suffer. And this is actually one of the reasons why the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths. To see that being of its essence is suffering. To be is to suffer. That goes against the grain for many people because we celebrate to be, so much so we're afraid of death. Most people are afraid of dying because they're not really quite sure what happens after they die and they're afraid they're going to be extinguished. It's fascinating why it is that when I talk like this, why people do get afraid. What are you afraid of?
I'm afraid of me disappearing. What's so bad about that? Fascinating. The greatest attachment you have is not to your physical possessions, it's not even to your loved ones. The greatest attachment you have is to yourself. That's why there's this story. I mentioned this in the last edition of the journal. The story which happened in Sarmati, where it was the king of Kosala, King Kasen, and his wife, what was the name? Malika, Queen Malika, was looking out the window when the Buddha was coming on arms round. And you know, she was devoted to the Buddha. And so she was just gazing at him, just with adoration. You know, maybe just like, you know, I was looking at one of the Buddha statues in that museum. This is my second favourite Buddha statue in the world, is there. I was just spent this afternoon just gazing at it, just enjoying it. It's a terracotta one done from Gandhara. And just, you can imagine that Queen Malika just looking at this incredibly inspiring figure of the Buddha walking on arms around. And the king caught her. What are you looking at him for? Are you in love with him? Who do you love more, he asked, me or the Buddha? And that's a very difficult question for the wife of a king to answer. Because if she answered it wrongly, she'd die. So she said, no, I love the Buddha more than the king. The king would be so upset, you know, he could kill her just like that. But if she said, no, I love the king more than the Buddha, that would be going against her faith. So given that very difficult question, she answered, I love myself more than the both of you. I love myself more than the both of you. And that just so astounded the king of Kosala, King Pasenadi, that he went almost immediately, sort of on that day, to the Jeta Grove to tell the Buddha about this. He said, look, this all happened in the morning. When you're on arms round, I caught my queen looking at you. I asked her this question, who do you love more, me or you? He said, I love myself more than both of you. And the Buddha said, Sadhu, Sadhu, that's a very wise queen you've got there. We're talking about the real love, the attachment to the sense of I, to being. Now, it's actually understanding what that being is. We're not really quite sure what it is we're attached to. But actually being is what existence is. And this is actually why when you get into these deep meditations, we understand what being truly is, what existence is. This is how it all works. You don't know what existence is, again, until, just like the sin of the tadpole on the pond, until some of it disappears. Because existence has always been around you. Being has been your birthright. You've been as long as you've known you. Sounds obvious, but when that being starts to fragment and disappear, you find out what it truly is. And this is what happens in the deep meditations of jhanas. Being starts to stop. And then you actually understand. Enlightenment, this is one of the definitions of enlightenment. It's in the Sanyutta Nikaya. It's called Bhava Nirodha. The cessation of being is Nibbana. Fascinating. So the point is, so why do I do this for? To end suffering. What is suffering? Martin is suffering. You are Duke. You might as well change your name. Instead of Martin Rat to Duke Rat. Instead of Sol Hannah to Sol Duke. Goes against the grain, but that's actually how it is.
When we were discussing it the other day as a group of people, we constantly kept on saying, how can we get rid of our ego? How do you do this if I do that thing? And it struck me that a number of things. It struck me firstly that our language is built around I and ego and soul and but also it struck me as this you know, I think therefore I am philosophy that we have in the West. And I suddenly thought, wait a second, we're trying to use all this culture and this understanding, this calculator that we've got to come up with a figure, if I use that analogy, which is on the screen of a calculator still. And we're saying that that charismatic doesn't exist. So it's like part of our culture that we're trying to intellectualize away. I was wondering whether there is any other culture or religion or philosophy that preaches or believes or follows or tries to achieve non-self, such as Buddhism does.
I don't know what other cultures do that. I haven't really studied anthropology or different cultures. But certainly this is, even in Buddhism, many Buddhist monks would sort of not understand what I was saying, and sometimes even argue with me, not really having seen just what's very clearly in the sutras and what's very clearly happens if you get into deep meditation. I think it's a lot of times because not enough monks and nuns practice jhanas. They don't get out of the pond, even for a short time. They still don't understand what water is. But it's interesting what you're saying about the eye wanting to let go of the eye. Because there's another, the Buddha saw that, and he calls that sort of vipavadanha, which is a craving to stop. And the reason he calls this is because it's I want to stop. I want to become an eye. I want to get rid of me. And he gave a very beautiful symbol. It's like a dog tied to a post, chasing its own tail. Can't just sleep. Circles around the same post. You can't get around that. You have to sort of get a new perceptual framework. You've got to sort of challenge, you've got to shock yourself to be able to see this. And that is the very purpose of jhanas. It shocks you. It gives you a kick, not up the backside, a kick up your jitha, up your mind. Which you never sort of expected anything like that could happen, or could exist, or be. And of course, when you get a shock like that, that's when even language changes. It's like they push an epiphany. See things a completely different way. My goodness. That's what it means. Does that make sense to you?
I don't understand that. There's one other time that I found interesting, maybe it is the closest thing that I've ever achieved to that. And that is occasionally walking along normally in a quiet environment or bush around, and all of a sudden I don't feel me at all. I actually feel like I'm part of the tree, part of the ground, part of the air. Is that a similar sensation?
It's getting there. It's just the same, I've often contemplated why. A lot of people, when they sort of die, they say the most important thing to them is their love, which they have for others. And I'm talking about not the last, I'm talking about their real love. And why is that for many people just the highest, most sacred thing? And it is because there's a lot of selflessness in the sort of sacrifice you give to others you love. You lose yourself in your love for others. It's the same as like being one with nature there. You're losing a lot of yourself, but not enough. It's on the way. So you can be one with nature and see nature disappear. Maybe it helps if you know some science and know that nature, all those trees and all those birds, are just full of holes. They're just little atoms. And the atoms are just, what is it? Just the protons, neutrons, electrons. And if you look at even what those, they're just full of holes, there's nothing there. Just a few quarks. Coming along, even the quarks are full of holes. The further you go, there's more holes, nothing there, just energies. It's just all just a play of illusion. It was great being a scientist because that would actually start to sort of bend your perceptions. And just to see just this floor in which you're sitting on, there's nothing there. There's just forces balancing each other. But really, it's just completely full of holes. And all that stuff which you bought at the shop, there's nothing there, it's just full of holes or something. It's true, there's nothing there, it's just, ask any scientist. 99.9999999999999, I don't know how many places, absolute emptiness and space. And all it is just a few little atoms, that's all. Just arranged in a certain way, and they've been flopped to you. You've been completely cheated, there's nothing really there. Yeah, go on.
In the development of human being, psychology says it's very important to develop a sense of self.
Uh-huh.
And is there another way in Buddhism to teach to indicate children, not to have a sense of self, and still allow them to fit in society.
This is the trouble with that Western psychology. It's very different from Eastern psychology. And all that Western psychology does is just make you just average crazy. Stops you from being sort of, you know, extremely crazy, just being average crazy. Just in other words, as crazy as the rest of us. And then you're considered to be sane. But Buddhism considers that to be, you know, really crazy. So, you know, we want to get rid of all craziness. And the sense of self, my goodness, that is not sort of a good thing to have in the end. Because I think many of you can see that the person has a strong sense of self, has a strong ego, a strong sense of wanting, a strong sense of attachment, and also a strong sense of protecting this thing they call a self. And when you know it, it's essentially that it's just a figment of your imagination. It's just a social construct. It's just made of conditioning. It's no part of our culture, but there's nothing there. So when you understand there's nothing there, you understand anyone who tries to create something like that, eventually it must fall apart, it must create trouble. So that, you know, I can see there's a huge problem there, an essential problem, because of the falsity of that assumption, that psychology which tries to make a real self. But actually eventually there will always be problems and troubles, psychosis, grief, guilt will come from that.
But Buddhist country, like Sri Lanka and other countries, have they developed a education system where there is no sense of self?
Well, it's very rare that anyone becomes an arahant and understands that the self is not there. But there is more selflessness, I suppose. More sense of community and less of individuality. More sense of family, extended family. More sense of the group. It's one of the difficulties which I'm sure that Booker's felt, that because we're mostly like Westerners, and if we have come from sort of an Asian background, we've been Westernized. So we're a bunch of individuals. We've got strong sense of egos and self. So it's very hard to say, get on the bus at this time, do this and do that. Because we're resistant to being organized and being herded. We've all done that. Okay, you want to do it? I want to do it my way. No, we want to go here. We want to go and do there. Why do I do it this way? We don't do it that way. Because we're resistant to that. We're not sort of. There has been some bonding on this journey together. We have been a group in many ways. We've also been very individualistic, wanting to do our own thing in our own way, at our own time. And that's the nature of being a Westerner or being Westernized. Whereas, if you look at that Thai group which was in Hotel Clark, a group of monks there and other people, but they're very close together, they would do things together. Much more so. That's one of the problems with the Western psychology. Very individualistic. There's a lot to be gained by that as well. There's something to be lost as well. Very strong with the ego, but also very, very lonely as well, because we can't create good relationships. Any other questions there? Say that no, you can't get a glimpse with doing the standard Vipassana. But many people who do the Vipassana technique get so close to jhanas, and if the teachers would just get out of the way, they get into the jhanas pretty easily. So, but they should never sort of discourage the jhanas. They're very, very important. And I can't see personally any way other than the jhanas. And I think I mentioned to you, mentioned in many talks, been quite forthright. There is no such thing as pure Vipassana taught by the Buddha. That comes in the commentaries much later. And the Buddha never said that. And I mentioned it during this pilgrimage, he said the only meditation which he praises. I think that was in the Gopika Moggallana Sutta, where the Buddha said, I think it's number 108, I think, where he said that the only four meditations which he praises, the only type of meditation he praises, are the four jhanas. That's the saying of the Buddha. The only meditation which the Buddha praised, well, first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, or fourth jhana. Well, that's quite a powerful statement. Now, fortunately, if there was an easy way, the Buddha would actually let you know. So you don't have to waste your time trying to find a new way. First jhana is sufficient. That's enough to say to kick up the jitter, especially to really sort of, you know, wow, something strange is happening here. It's not quite the way I thought it was. You see, the trouble with language. Language obviously stops there. All thinking stops. All wills, no, not all will stops, but 99% of it stops. So because of that, there's enough there for you to actually to see a different way, different experience, different way of looking. Yes? Yeah, correct. That is, it's the only way to get close to it. You have to do it that way, first of all. Better to learn these little techniques. And then eventually, when you do really get into a deep state of meditation, then you know that's, you know, what the Buddha was meaning. And the Buddha had high standards. He would still obviously encourage you to sit down and just to watch the breath. That was a good thing to do. But the one he really commended said, "Wow, that's a real meditation. It's a jhanas. So don't stop until you've got the jhanas. Or at least one anyway. Or at least one experience of a jhana." That's why, you know, that when I teach the meditation retreats, the 9 days which I teach, and I just make just the whole thing, just try as best I possibly can, give all of the instructions, all of the comforts, everything to try and get those jhanas going. Just I do it for that one purpose. It's a strange thing. I remember my first meditation teacher. He was a Thai man. He was a monk, but disrobed. Some of the things he said, which I remember now, were just obviously things way ahead of his time. So I remember him saying that, "I'm teaching you meditation for one reason, so you can get into the first absorption, that's all." That was his goal. I can say, well, that's my goal too, when I teach meditation. To get you guys and girls, just to experience, just one jhana. That's enough. To get to understand what I'm talking about, what the Buddha was about. And people do it, they can get those things. Yeah?
If an arahant was to be judgmental, which of course he's not, but if he was, and he was to look upon us, would we be seen as neurotic narcissists?
Quite likely. But no, so the thing is that arahants are not judgmental. They just find it funny. It's just good for a laugh.
So, like the other night, we spoke about the set of rigid rules that we create around the I and the self, and then the associated guilt and sin that we feel through the distortion of those rules. And I couldn't help but think that if there is a narcissist who is neurotic, those rules and those paranoias tend to become extremes of everything they do. And if you're saying that if you head towards non-self, then the opposite will occur. The rules, the paranoias, the sins, the guilt will start disappearing because the non-self steadily becomes more concerned about the people around them, about their position, you know, about looking after society, and then ultimately about attaching to the body. Is that how such a transition might occur from our fairly traditional rigid set of rules to...
Correct, yeah. I think it was Socrates, I think, reading in Plato's Republic, I remember reading that long time ago, was saying it's a waste of time really having rules. So because, you know, the rules, people will not keep them unless they really understand why. The rules have to come from within. They shouldn't be sort of put from the outside of society. It's like, you know, the government of West Australia has speeding rules, but people don't keep it unless they really understand why. It's a waste of time having speed cameras. I don't mean, you know, for some revenue reason. I mean, it's a waste of time because, and if people don't understand why, there's not much point having a rule there. The rules have to come from within. Otherwise, people will always be breaking them. They just try not to get caught, that's all. So the point of rules is actually, should really be intrinsic for a person's understanding of life and not be actually imposed from outside by other people. That's the, you know, the ideal state, and that ideal state comes from the enlightened ones. They don't need the rules because they understand, you know, why those rules were there in the first place. The artificiality of the rules is transcended by just the natural kindness and harmlessness. So that's why the precepts, all the rules of a monk, become unnecessary. At the same time, become completely perfected. When the one is enlightened, one just can't break the rules anymore. This is no way one can be imperfect. Does that make sense? So just out of five precepts, you just see an animal, you won't be able to kill it. What do you want to kill an animal for? What do you want to steal for? You want to try and get rid of things, not collect more things and steal. Committing adultery, that's a stupid thing to do. I don't want to hurt somebody else's, the husband or the girl or your fancy or whatever. You don't want to do things like that. And lying doesn't make sense. And also taking alcohol or drugs, expensive, complete waste of time. You don't need that for happiness. And all the other things, like calling people stupid or a dog or whatever. What do I bad mouth people for? Why even do you want to have an argument for? It's not worth having an argument about, you know, whether it should be this way or that way. It's just all chicken and duck stuff, as Ajahn Chah used to say. Even on this trip, people had arguments because was it this way, was it that way? It doesn't really matter whether it's this way or that way. People want to call it soup or they want to call it curry, I don't care. Just eat it, that's all. So it's just, you know, just chickens and ducks, that's all it is. Is it chicken soup or duck soup? Who cares? What I do care about is people have harmony and peace. So when you have like wisdom, you don't tend to get into arguments. So you can see that the enlightened one doesn't need rules.
Just a question on the judgment.
Yeah? Yeah. That's right, yeah. Yeah, I suppose what I mean by judgmental is like, you know, good and bad and grading people that way. But just obviously the discriminating, you know, between, you know, he's a girl, he's a boy. Now, of course, I have to be discriminating. Every time that you sort of go to see a toilet, you've got to discriminate, is that a girl's toilet, is that a boy's toilet? So, you know, I can't go in the girls' toilet. Don't call me sort of judgmental or preference or stuck to my rules by always going in the boys' toilet. It's obviously a good reason for that. So there's like the practicalities of life as well as the Buddha was. But not in judgmental saying that you're better or you're worse. That makes sort of sense. But it's true, the Buddha is judgmental. You've got to be discriminating. Yeah?
Oh,
no, low people can attain jhanas, do attain jhanas.
So there's no need to become a jhana or be able to attain
You don't have to become a monk to become get a chance, but I'll give you a warning. If you do get jhanas, you will become very interested in being a monk. You actually understand why there are monks. Because now after a while, I can't say that. But you understand if somebody actually gets a jhana, you know, especially when in their lay life, it'll be one of the reasons why they sort of decide to give it all up and become a monk or become a nun. Because once you understand what the states are, just the bliss of them, the meaning of them, the lay life doesn't mean anything much to you anymore. You know, getting married, having a family, having sex, you know, becoming wealthy, going to work in the morning, it just, you've got something else which is more pure and more meaningful. So it's just like, this is a saying of the Buddha, a simile of the Buddha. He said it's like this blind person heard this hawker coming along, Banaras silk, do you want some buy some Banaras silk? It's a really beautiful silk, very clean, very pure, very expensive. And the blind man said, okay, yeah, I'll have some of that. And so he buys it, and he wears this, you know, he's very proud, he's got this Banaras silk tunic. And then a doctor comes along and actually cures his sight. And he sees this beautiful sari, or beautiful tunic, which he's just bought in the shops. It's this most ugly, dirty, smelliest thing. Mm-hmm. I've been tricked, he says. Because I was blind, I didn't realize I was being sold a lemon. You've all been sold a lot of lemons, obviously. But if you get jhanas and stuff, what am I doing this for? It's actually stupid. You're buying all this stuff and stuff, you know. Have you got enough stuff? Enough clothes? Enough things? And think, I'm giving it to somebody else. You're giving them all these problems. And I'm going to give these presents, and I've got to accept it because, you know, she gave it to me or he gave it to me. Next time you go out to a pilgrimage, buy a little box and wrap it up in the most beautiful paper and put, you know, to my loved one on it and give it to them as a gift from India. And what is it? Essence of Buddha. Nothing in there. An empty box. I did, but you weren't listening. Essence of Buddha, the empty box. So actually, in the museum today, is one of the friezes there, of the empty seat. It's the Buddha's empty seat, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, sir. Okay, so. Who had their hands up? We'll answer those questions and then we'll stop. So it's just one and two and catching up. And that's only three more questions. Yes, sir.
When you submit your answer, I just want to say from us, Singapore, we are very happy that we have been able to join this Australian for this pilgrimage. Whatever price we have paid, whatever hotel we have stayed, and whatever food we have eaten, is not important. Most important was we are able to come with great teachers like Ajahn Brahm and the other Ajahn.
Sadhu. Does anyone dare to ask a question after that? Now you had your question, did you want? The reason you do come out of it, but it's hard to come out because the will has stopped. There's nothing to take you out of jhana, because there's no will. That's the reason, because it's still. When it's still, there's no way you can actually come out. Until sort of the past karma from the past eventually starts to wobble the jhana, you come out naturally. You can't choose. This is why these are strange states. You lose control. And we think, that's terrible, I've lost control. It's a wonderful thing for me to lose control. Become so still and peaceful. Can't you know? There was some what?
Some games.
Games? Oh yeah, sure. Lots of games, because especially the people who are incredibly crazy can actually get normal crazy. But it's good. Western psychology has some amazing things in it as well. But this is Buddhist practice goes that bit further. Okay. Do you have a question on here?
The question is just to the same quality people and the background, or is it different thoughts on the website? And for people like us who are not a temple or anyone, they have to live. And we
have
to drive about 2 hours to offer food.
Yeah.
So
that's from Texas, isn't it?
No, New Zealand.
New Zealand, sorry.
Yeah,
yes.
Not the Auckland. So we have Ajahn
Chandra
for at the moment. But we have to drive about 2.5 hours to offer food.
Okay.
So I think people living in Perth are really lucky to have all these extra months and to have the opportunity to go through a Friday night talk. And I'd like to thank for this present and past continuing work of the TSWA for giving me all the talks on the internet, on the website, so that people in other places could like us have the opportunity to listen to the talks. And I have downloaded all the talks and listened to every one of them, and it has changed my life.
Very good. It's very good. It's coming into the speech times. Do you want to say something?
Thank you. Good evening to Ajahn Brahm and Venerable Nisarano, Venerable Mohito and Venerable Advocata. On behalf of the group, I would like to express our deepest gratitude to the Ajahn for his for all of them, their compassion and their patience during the pilgrimage. We have all benefited enormously from his talks and meditation, guided meditation, which he gave each evening, and that gave us lots of inspiration. Ajahn's metta and wisdom is apparent everywhere we went. I am sure when we leave for home, each of us will bring back memorable experiences we had in this holy land, which would enhance our practice and faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And lastly, to end off, we would like to give a big thank you to Palini for her tireless effort in organizing the pilgrimage, in making everybody comfortable and happy. And also her efforts to make the trip as smooth as possible, as pleasant, under such tiring conditions. Thank you.